from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. In his blockbuster new book, Capital in the 21st Century, French economist Thomas Piketty looks deep into the history of capitalism and wealth in Europe and the United States. From that data, he says the 20th century gave us an unrealistic view of capitalism, that without giant disruptions like World War and Depression, capitalism tends to radically concentrate wealth to a degree that challenges democracy. And it's doing that again now, he says. His solution? A tax on wealth and more. His status right now? Sudden superstar. This hour on Point, Thomas Piketty on capitalism and the way ahead. We'll hear a critique of Piketty's white-hot bestseller in this hour from big economist Gregory Mankiw, top advisor economic to George W. Bush and Mitt Romney. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Are you concerned about growing inequality? What's to be done? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Paris is Thomas Piketty, author of the blockbuster book just out in English, Capital in the 21st Century. Sounds heavy, but it's selling like crazy. It's currently number one on Amazon's bestsellers list. He's being talked about all over the world. For an excerpt, you can go to our website, onpointradio.org. He's an economics professor at the Paris School of Economics. Thomas Piketty, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for joining us.
Hello, Tom, and thanks for inviting me.
What is the story about capitalism that your research is disrupting?
Okay, first of all, let me say that, you know, this is a book about the history of capitalism, about the history of income and wealth. And, you know, primarily this comes from a collective data collection project with many colleagues from over 20 countries, Tony Atkinson in the UK, Manuel Saez in the US, mm-hmm. Facundo Alvaredo in Argentina. We've been collecting all this data. And, you know, the primary purpose of the book is just to present all this data, you know, in a consistent manner. And let me say very clearly that, you know, just like everybody, I am better at analyzing the past than the future. And, you know, people can very well disagree with the policy conclusions I draw for the future and still find some interest in, you know, the first three parts of the book, which I think in a readable way try to put together the story of income and wealth and the story of the social groups that lie behind income and wealth percentiles and deciles. And you know, I think this is a topic for everybody, not only for economists. And, you know, I hear some interpretation of my book that go in the direction of, you know, very pessimistic conclusion. And I am actually less pessimistic than some of this interpretation might tend to suggest. You know, I think there are forces going in different directions. There are different possible futures. Ultimately, it depends on, you know, the institution and the policy choices that we make. One of my points is that, you know, there's no natural force that guarantees that, you know, the inequality of income and wealth will remain at some, you know, reasonable level, whatever this means. And, you know, it can very well happen that in the coming decades, we keep having, you know, rising concentration of income and, more importantly, of wealth. And yes, we might return to the kind of extreme concentration of wealth that we had in the 19th century and up until World War One in pretty much every country, particularly in every European country. And, you know, I think this is potentially threatening for our democratic institution. And also, this is just useless for growth. You know, one of the lessons of the 20th century is that we don't need 19th century inequality to grow. You know, we certainly need some inequality, you know, but, you know, extreme concentration of wealth with 90% of national wealth belonging to the very top 10% of the population, as we had in the 19th century and until World War One, you know, was not useful for growth. You know, in the 20th century, a middle class emerged, And you know, if anything, this was good for growth. And now there's a risk that in the future, this middle class share in national wealth will shrink. And you know, we should all be concerned with this and look at possible solutions.
Professor Piketty, I mean, there is certainly plenty of data in here. In some ways, the capacity to collect all this data that you now have with modern technology is what made this book possible, this very deep and large analysis possible. But this is anything but a book of dry statistics. And you're talking here, yes, there's plenty of charts and graphs, but you very much embrace the role of the political economist as well. You're talking about the narrative of capitalism, how we came to understand it in the 20th century. And one of your central points is that the 20th century was, in a way, left us with some illusions about capitalism. That capitalism, without these giant interventions of World War and Great Depression and the way they turned everything topsy-turvy, capitalism tends to concentrate wealth, and you see us very possibly, likely even, back on that path now. Am I wrong?
Well, there are different ways to make capitalism a better place, and you know, to make capitalism a more equal place. Now, during the 20th century, it is true that a number of unusual events, you know, some tragic and some more positive, happen, which played a very large role. And I think it's important to be aware of this historical record. So, you know, during most of human history, and pretty much until World War I, the rate of return to capital was much larger than the growth rate of the economy, simply because the growth rate was very small. You know, before the Industrial Revolution, it was close to 0%. And even in the 19th century, in spite of all the innovation, you know, the invention of, you know, at the end of the 19th century, the invention of the automobiles, the electricity, radio, you know, the productivity growth rate until World War I were 1 to 1.5% per year, which was much less than the rate of return to capital, typically 4, 5, sometimes 6% on more risky investment. And this large gap implied a very large concentration of wealth. Now, in the 20th century, this traditional equilibrium was disturbed by a number of indeed very unusual events. You know, first between 1914 and 1945, because of war destruction, because of the Great Depression, because of inflation, because of the rise of taxation, the rate of return to private wealth was indeed reduced to very low level. The other unusual event is that the post-war reconstruction period was characterized in many countries by unusually high growth rate, you know, particularly in continental Europe and in Japan, but also to some extent in the US. The other unusual event that made growth rate particularly large in the post-war period was the very large growth of population. You know, it's important to realize that when we look at GDP growth statistics, about half of historical growth in GDP was due to population at the world level. And until today, this has been an important force of growth. Now, will this continue in the future? You know, it could be, you know, according to demographic projections, that indeed population growth is going to decline pretty much everywhere. And this per se tends to reinforce the relative importance of wealth accumulated in the past relative to new output and new saving out of new output. And so it is quite likely that the growth rate, particularly because of this decline in population growth, will be again substantially lower than the rate of return to capital in the 21st century. And this per se can lead to a rising concentration of wealth, which we've seen already, you know, not only in the US, but also in Europe and at the world level. The top of the distribution of wealth, if you look at top billionaires or top millionaires, they've been rising roughly three times as fast as the size of the world economy over the past 2 to 3 decades, which, you know, means that the concentration of wealth is rising. Now, how far this is going to go? What's going to be exactly the value of the growth rate and rate of return to capital in the future? You know, I don't know. But I think the fact that we don't know how far this is going to go is per se a problem and potentially, you know, a threat for our democratic institution. And, you know, I guess all what I'm saying is we need to find a democratic institution, including more financial transparency, more transparency about wealth dynamics, so that we can, you know, react and adjust, in particular, our tax system to what we observe. And, you know, if that does not happen, then that will be fine. But I think, you know, we should not just wait for, you know, these natural forces to solve the problem. We should prepare for other options as well.
You say just now that if we don't respond in that way, that would be fine. But in your book, you describe real threats to democracy and social justice if democracies don't step up and get more transparency and maybe a rather different tax system as well.
No, that's right. I think, you know, above a certain point, concentration of wealth can become a threat for democratic institutions because, you know, it creates so much inequality in political voice and, you know, access to and production of information and political influence that, you know, I think this is potentially quite damaging for democratic ideal. And the threat is that a growing fraction of the population, you know, will tend to turn against globalization, which per se is a good thing, of course.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with the hottest thinker on the planet right now, economist Thomas Piketty, about the economy we live in, about wealth, inequality, and the society our economy creates. His blockbuster bestseller, just recently translated into English, is Capital in the 21st Century. It's had a very excited reception around the planet. Much positive, negative as well. People who don't like it say, hey, here comes Marx in all new clothing. But it's a very deep look based on deep assessment of the data about the history of capitalism, looking at trends there, what we've seen, what we are likely to see in this century. Thomas Piketty joins us today from Paris. We'll be joined in a moment by big economist Gregory Mankiw, who has maybe a more conservative view of the world, the economy, and I look forward to hearing his critique, his exchange with Professor Piketty. He'll join us in the studio in a moment. Thomas Piketty, in Paris, you write in your book about the days of Jane Austen and Balzac, and yes, for that matter, David Ricardo and Karl Marx. Are you taking us back to a 19th century view of capitalism or something else?
Well, you know, I think it's useful to have this long-run historical perspective. You know, some people seem to believe that, you know, the future will be different and there's nothing to learn from history. And in particular, you know, I read some reviews saying that, you know, pre-World War I European countries were, you know, agrarian countries, there's nothing to learn from them. You know, I think this is wrong. You know, I think 1900, 1910 was a time where, you know, the automobile was invented, the radio, the electricity. So, you know, maybe that's less important than Facebook, but, you know, still, these are important innovations. So this was an innovating economy. Stock market capitalization in London or Paris was higher as a percentage of GDP than, you know, what it is today in the US. So this was, in many ways, a very modern, vibrant economy. And still, the degree of inequality and concentration of wealth was just enormous. And you know, I think there's a lot to learn from history. You know, of course, the lessons we can draw are always complicated. And again, I don't claim the conclusion I draw at the end of my book are the only possible conclusions. And, you know, my main objective is to sort of help everybody to write their own conclusion and to provide all this historical evidence so that, you know, democratic debate and, you know, everybody will make their own mind. But, Yeah, I think there's a, you know, the 19th century economy and the pre-World War I economy has a lot of lessons for today's world and for our understanding of the future.
Thomas Piketty in Paris, we have lots of callers for you. Let's try and get a couple right here, if I may. James in Weymouth, Massachusetts. James, thank you for calling. You're on the air with Professor Thomas Piketty.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I was wondering if Thomas could explain a country that exists today that he believes gives much more opportunity and mobility. I have probably a dozen friends that are millionaires, and none of them were born that way. They were all able to build businesses and empires, little empires of their own, and become very mobile and be very successful.
Thomas Piketty, what about it? You've worked in the United States. You say you've tasted the American dream. James kind of describes a piece of it there. And, so, you know, the suggestion is, what's wrong with a system that has made a lot of his friends millionaires?
Oh, look, there's a lot to learn from the U.S. You know, I think there's a lot to learn from Europe as well. There's a lot to learn from every country. You know, there's no perfect system, and just we have to, you know, to design our institutions so as to adapt to the changing world. But, you know, I'm certainly not saying that everything is wrong about today's capitalism. You know, I believe in market forces and private property, not only because it's a very, efficient system at producing new wealth, but also, you know, because it's, to me, a condition of personal freedom. So, I'm not at all, entirely negative about this. I'm just saying that if you look carefully at the wealth rankings and produced by magazines or other data sources, you will find a lot of self-made wealth, entrepreneur, but you will also find a lot and actually a rising amount of inherited wealth, and you will also see that above a certain wealth level, you have a rate of growth of very large portfolio, which is much, much larger than, the rate of return that, typical middle-class family will get. And this means that, you have a tendency, once you have accumulated a certain quantity of wealth, for the concentration of wealth to keep rising, and the inequality in rate of return that different portfolio size access these days is certainly evidence for that, or at least from the imperfect data we have, wealth levels above 100 million or 1 billion seem to be rising at 6-7% per year. Of course, a middle class family doesn't get that kind of rate of return right now. So this creates a tendency toward excessive concentration of wealth, but that doesn't mean that we want to go to full equality of wealth. Right now the bottom half of the U.S. population owns about 2% of U.S. national wealth. If it was full equality, it should be 50%. And I'm not saying it should be 50%. I'm just saying that, maybe we can do better than 2%. And there must be ways, to change the tax system and other institutions so as to do better than 2%.
Mm-hmm. Phyllis in Roslindale, Massachusetts. Phyllis, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you. I have kind of a comment. I want to thank Mr. Piketty.
Mm-hmm.
What's been, I'm really happy to talk about is this concept of equating capitalism with democracy, which people have been doing for many, many years. I've heard it even on air in your show, and I've tried to call because they are not the same thing. And in fact, unfettered capitalism, as we can see, it creates the opposite of a democracy. Obviously, when people have so much money, their influence is huge in proportion to the And gun control is just one example of where this comes in, but there's many of them. And I just think that I really would like to hear more about this equating of democracy and capitalism and how it in fact creates the opposite.
Phyllis, I appreciate your call. Thomas Piketty in Paris, you describe extreme concentrations of wealth, extreme inequality, as a threat to democracy, beyond that to social justice. In your conclusion, you say the consequences for the long-term dynamics of wealth distribution are potentially terrifying. What's the threat that you see?
Well, I think, you know, capitalism should be the slave of democracy rather than the opposite. So we need to build on capitalism, but we need to make sure that the concentration of wealth into a small number of hands does not get too extreme. Otherwise, you know, the risk is simply a capture of the political process by a top group. And I think to some extent, this is, we've already seen that in the past. You know, this is what was happening to some extent in European societies prior to World War One, and sometime when the political system was not responding at that time. You know, there was very mm-hmm. large concentration of wealth, and look, a country like France, you know, they didn't want to create the income tax, and it's only because of World War One that, you know, the progressive income tax was created. In the US, actually, the political system was working better in a way. You know, I think largely because there was a middle class in the US at that time. You know, the inequality of income and wealth was actually much larger in France or Britain or in Europe more generally than in the US. And I think that's partly the reason why the you know, European democratic systems were working less well. Now, today, it goes in the opposite direction, although, you know, European democratic institutions are certainly not a model for anyone right now. No, we have to learn from this experience to try to avoid the kind of frustration which eventually can come if we don't find democratic, peaceful way of making sure that the, you know, very large fraction of the population benefits from our free market system and from globalization.
You offer a solution to try to produce that, in your view, I guess. And it goes to taxation. And you say probably the only way to slow down extreme concentration of wealth is through a number of steps, but among them, a tax on wealth, a global tax on wealth. That sounds politically very difficult, but so we can at least think about it. What do you mean? And what scale of tax? On what kind of wealth?
Oh, first of all, there's a lot that can be done at the country level, you know, especially in large countries like the United States or China. You know, for European countries, which are small countries at the world level, they need certainly to unite to make progress. But if you take, the US is one quarter of world GDP, so, you know, the United States have the capacity to change their tax system without asking the permission to other countries. So the way it would work is, you know, take the property tax. Right now, this is the main tax on wealth in the US. I would prefer to have a progressive tax on net wealth. So the difference will be that right now, you know, if you take an average family with a house worth $500,000, you know, if you have a mortgage of $490,000, you know, in fact, you're not very rich. Your net wealth mm-hmm. is only $10,000. So in my system, you know, if that was a progressive tax on net wealth, you know, typically this family will pay much less than it does today. So for the, you know, the bottom 50%, the bottom 90% of families, they will pay less. But for those who have a lot of financial assets and whose total net wealth is, you know, dozens of millions of dollars, you know, they will pay more. You know,
up to 10% at the top of the wealth span, as I read you.
Well, we have to be very pragmatic about that. We have to look at the speed at which the different wealth groups are currently rising. So, you know, if the top of the distribution of wealth is rising just at the same speed as the average, you know, 1 or 2% per year, then there's no need to have, extra tax rate at the top. Now, on the contrary, if the top is rising at 6-7% or 10% or 15% per year, then, you know, you have to adjust the tax rate. So, you know, it's not that I know the answer, the exact tax rate that should be implied. I think one of the purposes of the tax system is also to produce information and to produce democratic transparency and accountability and income and wealth, so that we can adapt the tax rate to what we observe. And so, you know, let's be very, very pragmatic and see at what speed the middle class and the top of the distribution are rising, and let's adjust the tax rate. Our system of property taxation both, you know, in the United States and in Europe, was built in actually in the early 19th century at a time where real estate property was the main source of wealth and where financial assets and financial liabilities were not that important. This is why they are not taken into account in property tax. Now, the problem is that in the 21st century, this is a pretty archaic system of taxation. So especially if the relative importance of wealth in comparison to income and GDP tends to rise over time, I think it's important to rethink our system of wealth taxation, not to increase wealth taxation overall, but just to make it more progressive. So to increase wealth mobility and access to wealth for those who are trying to accumulate wealth.
Thomas Piketty with a political hot potato there, you can see, but he says it's because if we don't take steps to monitor and intervene, we'll have wealth concentration so great that it begins to undercut democracy. Thomas Piketty joins us from Paris. With me right now in the studio, and please stand by, Professor Piketty, is Gregory Mankiw, economics professor, chairman of the economics department at Harvard University. From 2003 to 2005, he was chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors under President George W. Bush. He was an economic advisor to Mitt Romney for both of Romney's presidential campaigns. He's vice president of the American Economic Association. Gregory Mankiw, thank you very much for being with us today.
It's nice to be with you.
First of all, you've seen the huge splash that Thomas Piketty's book has made, not just in this country, but really all over the world at this point. Why do you think there's been such a reception? It's not all positive. It's been positive, negative, but just overall a big reception to this narrative, this book.
Let me start by congratulating Thomas on the success of his book. It's quite rare to have a top economist like Thomas write a 700-page tome on a serious economic topic and have everybody read it. Most people would rather have root canal than pick up a book on economics. So I'm impressed and I applaud his success in this. I think he's picked up on a topic that's very much on people's minds, which is increasing inequality. It's definitely a phenomenon. It's something that President Barack Obama has been talking about. So I think it's on the people's minds in the United States. And so I think it makes sense that when there's a serious academic treatment of it, especially one that's as accessible as this book is, that people want to pick it up and read it. And I think I would encourage people to do so.
Do you agree with him that in the 20th century we picked up on a maybe false narrative about capitalism, that it over time goes toward a happy medium of distribution that supports democracy, so just let it roll and everything will be fine?
Well, I think there's several parts of Thomas's book. I mean, the part of it is economic history that is looking backwards, and that's the part that I actually find the most fascinating and the most compelling. I think it's really a very interesting look, and I think we may have had some unusual features in the 20th century that may be unique to that
World
time
War
period.
And so on.
World War.
Wars.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I think the part where I think I part company with Thomas more is looking forward. That is, he has this premise called which he calls the central contradiction of capitalism, which is that we're in trouble if the rate of return on capital is greater than the growth rate, that the economy is going to tend toward increasing inequality. Mm-hmm.
Which he says it naturally is, in his estimation.
And there I think I'd part company, in part because I don't see the wealth increasing at the rate of return on capital. And that's simply because people spend their money when they have capital. Some of it's in consumption in the form of fancy vacations and luxury houses and fancy cars, and some of it's in form of charitable giving. What wealth tends to get dissipated as people have children, it gets split up multiple ways. So I don't see wealth as naturally growing at the rate of return on capital. And as a result, I don't see that the wealth concentration is continuing to increase.
And yet we have rising concentration.
We have, but that's been in part not because I think of R and G, that is the rate of return on capital, mm-hmm. and the growth rate, but rather we've within labor income, we've had certain people having a lot more success than others. We've seen increasing gaps, and this is not between capital and labor, this is between high income and low income laborers.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with the hottest thinker on the planet right now, economist Thomas Piketty, about the economy we live in, about wealth, inequality, and the society our economy creates. His blockbuster bestseller, and really unexpected, the publisher is back putting out new edition after new edition right now to try and keep up with demand, is Capital in the 21st century. Little echoes of Das Kapital there, yes, he says, but he's got his own view based on a very, very deep analysis of a huge period of data, more analysis of more data than maybe has ever been possible in the past. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Thomas Piketty joins us from Paris, France. And with me in the studio, big economist Gregory Mankiw. He was chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers under President George W. Bush, economic advisor to Mitt Romney. Thomas Piketty, I'm sure you heard that. Let me bring it to you. Gregory Mankiw saying, well, you know, the rate of growth, rate of return on capital is not the same as the rate of growth of wealth, because wealth is dissipated. People spend it. They spend it on yachts and vacations, and they divide it up between lots of kids. So maybe it doesn't matter so much.
Oh, sure. I agree that people will consume some of the return to wealth. You know, this is what wealth is here for. You know, what's the point of having property if you reinvest 100% of the return? So, of course, you know, in the very long run, you know, if you have a rate of return of 5% and a growth rate of 1%, you know, on average, people will reinvest only 1/5, 20% of the return and consume the other 4/5, 80%, you know, assuming there's zero tax. So I fully agree on this. But the problem is that this can go together with a huge concentration of wealth and also a very large perpetuation of wealth over time and across generation. And I think this, you know, raises problems regarding our democratic and meritocratic ideal. So my point is not that wealth will grow forever or that wealth inequality will grow forever. I agree with Greg that this will stop somewhere. All I am saying is that this somewhere can be pretty large, and the higher the gap between the rate of return and the growth rate, the higher the steady state and equilibrium concentration of wealth. And, you know, there's no natural force that brings this into at a reasonable level in any meaningful sense. This can get pretty extreme if you do simple simulation.
Gregory Mankiw, do you see a threat to our democratic and meritocratic ideals in the concentration of wealth?
I don't see wealth as big a problem as Thomas does. Let me give a concrete example. I'm given the success of his book, I'm sure that sometime over the next year, he's going to get a nice big royalty check from his publisher. He'll pay some income tax on that. And he'll have a choice between spending that on himself or saving it and perhaps leaving it to his children. If he decides to save it and leave it to his children, I don't see any problem with that. That will presumably increase concentration of wealth, but I don't see that as a threat to other people in society.
That's in his personal circumstance, but when it happens society wide, and his assertion is that the inequality grows, and that's just kind of perpetually happening in the absence of major disruptions. What about then? A threat to democracy?
I don't see it as a threat to democracy. If Thomas wants to keep his money in his family, that's fine. But I mean, I think the question is not how do we help people at the bottom, not how we thwart people at the top. I would much rather see, rather than the policies that taxed capital, if people accumulate too much, I'd rather see policies that encourage people at the bottom to accumulate capital. So, for example, things like automatic enrollment and 401k plans, so that the typical worker out there, when they get a job, put some of it away and they can start becoming capitalists as well.
What about it, Thomas Piketty? The idea there, let's not worry too much about the growth of wealth, wherever it may be, including at the top. Pay attention to helping the bottom, and there's not really a threat to democracy here.
Well, the primary purpose of the progressive tax on net wealth that I was describing earlier was actually to increase wealth mobility and to reduce actually the property tax that is now paid by people who are trying to accumulate wealth but who have very high mortgages. And, you know, sometimes you have people whose property value is even below their mortgage and they still pay the same property tax as someone who has, inherited their property or who has reimbursed their mortgage 20 years ago. And I think, this is crazy. I think net wealth is a much better indicator of your ability to contribute to the tax system. And in addition, this raises wealth mobility. Again, right now, the bottom half of the U.S. population owns 2% of U.S. national wealth. I'm not saying we should have perfect equality where it will be 50% by definition of national wealth for the bottom half. I'm just saying that, you know, it's hard to pretend that 2%, you know, is the best we can do. You know, I think there must be institutions that make it, you know, maybe to 5%, 8%, you know, I don't know, Greg, would you really say that 2% is the social optimum we can, you know, there's nothing more for the bottom half of the population we can do?
Greg, thank you.
I think when we start talking about questions like what's the optimum, you're going beyond economics and going into political philosophy. And if you let me evoke the name of two classic Harvard political philosophers, I think if we had John Rawls here, if he were still alive, he'd probably agree with you. And if we had Robert Nozick here, he'd probably disagree with you. And they wouldn't be agreeing or disagreeing on economic grounds. They'd be disagreeing on grounds of what the role of government is and what the fundamentals of political philosophy are.
But Thomas Piketty says economics is political. They're inseparable.
Well, I think we need. I would disagree with that. I think we need to think about what is economics and what are the facts and what's the forecast. And then when we think about normative economics, that is, what should we do? You have to realize that's not just a matter of science. That's a matter of philosophy. That's a matter of value judgments. And I think different political philosophers lead you in very different directions about what the role of government should be in this environment.
Thomas Piketty, you're quite willing, I think, to bring some value judgments into this arena. In fact, I think I read you arguing that they should be here.
Well, yeah, you know, I think more people will be Rawlsian in the sense that, you know, inequality is fine as long as it is in the interest of the most disadvantaged group in societies. And, Greg seems to be closer to a Nozickian viewpoint, which, frankly, I do not completely understand even from a logical viewpoint, because, you know, I think if you had really a perpetuation of wealth across generation, you know, you surely don't want to return to a, you know, Downton Abbey kind of society. So it must be in the back of your mind, Greg, that you have the view of a natural mechanism that prevents this from happening. You know, you cannot believe that, you know, any degree of inequality, any degree of perpetuation of inequality across generation is acceptable because this comes from, you know, free choices 10 generations ago. You know, at some point, equal opportunity between people who do not inherit anything and people who do inherit. Or, you know, are you against any form of taxation of inheritance? I mean, I remember that George W. Bush wanted to abolish any form of inheritance taxation, but so are you in favor of that?
I mean, I think the optimal tax system would be a progressive consumption tax. And if people choose, if you when you get your royalty check, you decide to save it rather than spend it, I think you should finally pay tax when you do decide to spend it, which is what a progressive consumption tax would do. But I don't see any reason why people saving their earnings either for themselves in the future or for their children is something that the government itself should be worried about. I think we need to focus, myself, not on inequality, but rather standards of living, and worry about things like the educational system being not providing adequate human capital for people at the bottom, worrying that some people at the bottom aren't saving enough for their own future, which is why I mentioned automatic enrollment in 401k plans. So I think we need to worry about equality of opportunity, but I'm not sure that necessarily means worrying about wealth accumulation at the top as opposed to inadequate human and physical capital accumulation at the bottom.
Let me take a call from Marilyn in Newton, Massachusetts. Marilyn, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling because it seems to me what it comes down to, what I'm worried about and what most people I'm in contact with worry about, is that wealth in this country now has come to mean power. And that the power is in the hands of those people who have the most money. Congress, we know, is replete with millionaires, maybe even some billionaires. People, we have to look at the fact that these are not robots. These are people. They're not in contact with the way most people live. Also, the corporations seem to be ruling us, and we have no recourse. For example, I mean, many corporations work almost like utilities. We have to use them. We have to have control of the internet, and yet we worry about what is happening now with the FCC.
Yeah, Marilyn, if I may pick it up right there, I think we've got your point, and it's a strong one. Let me put it first to Gregory Mankiw. I mean, It seems to me there's a point at which politics inevitably comes deeply into economics, and Marilyn puts her finger right on it. I don't know about your family or others, but the story in my family is coming to this country to get away from societies in which entrenched wealth and aristocracy ran the show and there wasn't opportunity sufficient for others, where inequality was so great and so entrenched that it shut down human potential. Thomas Piketty seems to warn of that for us globally, including in this country now.
All four of my grandparents came to the United States about a century ago with no more from Ukraine, with no more than a fourth grade education. So my family has experienced the American dream, and I'm very much a big believer in it. The question is what to do going forward to help other people experience that American dream. And I think worrying about the education system and the fact that it's failing lots of people at the bottom is more important than worrying about wealth accumulation at the top.
Thomas Piketty, don't worry so much about wealth at the top. Worry about education at the bottom. Worry about the general standard of living. And if that's going up, even if it's not as fast as the wealthy, we're okay. What do you say to that?
Oh, I care mostly about the bottom. So, you know, education system, proper access to education is key. And I think, you know, inequality in access to higher education in the U.S. right now is very large. And you know, this is certainly, central issue to address. Now, I think that the tax system is also important. You know, I think education and taxation are both important. And I think, again, that, you know, reducing the property tax on people who have very little net wealth and who are just trying to accumulate, to enter the game and to start accumulating wealth is useful. I heard that Greg favored progressive taxation of consumption. So if I understand well, this means that if someone receives a large inheritance and starts consuming it, you should tax it. Now, from what I remember, under George W. Bush, there was an attempt to repeal the inheritance tax, but this was not replaced by such a progressive tax on consumption. So, you know, the problem is that very often when people support this solution of progressive taxation of consumption in order to replace progressive taxation of inheritance, you know, they suppress progressive taxation of inheritance, but then they forget to replace it by something else. So, you know, I think we have to be very careful here.
Let's get a call from Tunbridge, Vermont. Dan is on the line. Hi, Dan, you're on the air.
Hi, Professor. My question is, in the so-called golden age for the American middle class, which, you know, the end of World War II to 1980, what was the level of relative wealth the bottom 50% held during that time, which was marked by a relatively high top marginal rate and a high degree of social reinvestment by the government?
Thomas Piketty?
You know, the bottom 50% was not doing that much better. Maybe the maximum you will see will be 3 or 4%, which is still twice as much as 2%, but this was not so much better. The main difference will be for what I will call, you know, the middle class, which will be the next 40%. So people who are not in the bottom 50, but who are not either in the top 10. Now, this group, which I think is really central to the working of our democracy, you know, has been, their share in national wealth has been shrinking quite substantially. So, you know, they used to have closer to 30% of national wealth, and now they are closer to 20%, which is, you know, it's always been less than the top 10%, of course, but the top 10% has been moving from, you know, a little bit above 60 to now a little bit above 70 and getting closer to 75. So, you know, the trend is, you know, I think is not going in the right direction, in the sense that, you know, again, I'm not saying we need full equality of wealth, but I think a shrinking middle class is not good for our economy, and, you know, it's not good for growth either.
Gregory Mankiw, does it never keep you up at night thinking about exactly this, a shrinking middle class and its implications for democracy? I mean, this is where politics get tied right into economics. It's unavoidable.
Well, there's two aspects of this. I mean, one, we've been talking mainly about wealth inequality, but within the United States, it's not so much wealth inequality that's changed a lot as much as inequality within labor income. So high-income earners, as Thomas knows and talks about in his book, high-income earners in the United States are doing very, very well compared to middle class. So that's not wealth accumulation.
So
that's
fine,
income.
Take it by either measure. Does it not keep you up at night?
Sure, it does. And I think it's a political challenge. I think it's mainly driven by the forces of education and technology. I mean, there's a great book by...
Not capitalism itself.
I don't think it's capitalism itself. There's a book by two of my Harvard colleagues, Claudia Golden and Larry Katz, called The Race Between Education and Technology. And their basic story is that technology tends to favor skilled workers over unskilled workers, and education is the way we transform unskilled workers into skilled workers. And what we need to do is increase educational attainment in order to combat the forces of technology that tends to increase inequality.
Thomas Piketty, you speak a lot about knowledge as one way out of this inequality, but is it sufficient in your view? We've just got a minute remaining here. And what's the risk if we don't find some way to close this growing gap, Professor Piketty?
The diffusion of knowledge and education is the key force for, you know, reducing inequality. And I fully agree with Greg here. And I you know, this book by Goldin and Katz is a great book. Now, I think this is not sufficient. You know, the spread of education, you know, is central. But we also need ways to, you know, to ensure that the rising, you know, ability of very tiny group of top income earners sometimes to set their own pay to levels that have sometimes not much to do with their productivity. You know, over the past few decades in the US, you have a huge rise in top managerial compensation and rising inequality everywhere except in the growth statistics. You know, the per capita GDP growth in the US has not been terribly good in the past few decades as compared to the previous period. And so, you know, it's not clear that this is a good deal for the rest of the population.
And maybe not for democracy either. It's being described as a game-changing narrative. We will see how it gets absorbed in this country and around the world. Fascinating to hear the two of you work it over just a little bit today, and we're very grateful for that. Gregory Mankiw, Chairman of the Economics Department at Harvard University, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
And Thomas Piketty in Paris, it must be some wild ride for you. It will be amazing to see where these ideas go over time. Thank you very much for your work and your time today, Professor Piketty.
Thank you.
Thomas Piketty, author of Capital in the 21st Century, an unexpected blockbuster. Listeners, thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.